This is Medea Benjamin. I hope you listen to Community Radio KBOO 90.7.
Today on Wings, each November 11th, hordes of people don artificial red poppies in the U.S., Canada, Australia, the U.K., and some other Commonwealth countries to honor the sacrifice of soldiers during war. Kathleen Barry explored that sentiment in her book, Unmaking War, Remaking Men, How Empathy Can Reshape Our Politics, Our Soldiers, and Ourselves.
We have this very elegant term that the politicians and the president use many times a day, the soldier's sacrifice, which is supposed to pull us in to a patriotism behind those soldiers so that they will not have died in vain.
There's a river of birds in migration, a nation of women with wings. There's
Welcome to Wings, a series of news and current affairs programs by and about women around the world, produced and distributed by the Women's International News Gathering Service.
Introducing Kathleen Barry is Kate Raphael of KPFA Women's Magazine in Berkeley, California.
Kathleen Barry is a former professor and the author of 5 books, including Female Sexual Slavery and Susan B. Anthony, A Biography of a Singular Feminist, and she is the editor of Vietnamese Women in Transition, a collaboration with the Vietnamese Women's Research Program. For her activism and scholarship on sexual trafficking, she received the Wonder Woman Award and was named by Marie Claire magazine one of the 100 women who most changed the world for women. Her new book is Unmaking War, Remaking Men. Kathleen, welcome to Women's Magazine. Why don't you start by telling us about your life and how you came to activism?
The activism started with the civil rights movement in 1961. I lived in a very segregated northern city, Syracuse, New York, and I was about 20 years old and could not stand this terrible treatment of blacks in the city at that time. So I joined CORE, and we started demonstrating. And then I found something running through my blood that, you know, you can make a difference when you get out there and act. And that just, from that moment on, stuck with me. I stayed in the civil rights movement. I was teaching. I was a teacher at the time. And then it moved into the anti-war movement, and particularly the white men in the anti-war movement and civil rights movement became intolerable. They really treated us women as if, you know, we were there to make their coffee. Somebody said one day, one of the women said to one day, I hear that there's a women's liberation group organizing. They're having a meeting next Wednesday. I said, we're on. And from then on, that was probably 67, and the very beginning of consciousness raising. So I had the privilege of going through that whole period of consciousness raising, which has never left me, because I learned to understand that you can actually make change, that whether it's one person, a small group, a mass movement, you don't have to sit back and take it. And, of course, consciousness raising is a way of critical thinking. Eventually, I went on with school, became a sociologist, finished at UC Berkeley, taught, but I always taught feminist theory and courses related to women, globalization. Working on violence against women in the late 70s, I ended up writing my first book, which was called Female Sexual Slavery, which really got a lot of attention. It was the first book, a serious book, to come out on the trafficking in women and girls around the world. And it had been treated as a kind of 19th century problem that probably was made up. And I broke through all of that, redefined trafficking in relation to prostitution as a form of slavery when somebody's in a situation they cannot get out of and are sexually exploited and physically abused. And that opened up a whole floodgate. This whole movement started from that, the movement against trafficking in human beings. UNESCO picked up on it. I worked with UNESCO and the Human Rights Commission at the United Nations for a while on that. I'm still teaching that kind of thing. And found the Coalition Against Trafficking in Women, an NGO of the United Nations. Women started organizing shelter programs for women who'd been trafficked or been in prostitution. Movements started to develop. The coalition that I organized had a base in each world region. So I felt like after about 30 years of that kind of work that I could step back a little bit. And then one day I got kind of angry about war and masculinity in war. We were, you know, a few years into the war in Iraq, and Israel was bombing Lebanon, and I picked up a pen and paper and started writing with no intention of writing a book, and this new book, Unmaking War, Remaking Men, came out. So I'm back out and at it again with the activism, the writing.
And the subtitle of this book is How Empathy Can Reshape Our Politics, Our Soldiers, and Ourselves. And you begin with a story that doesn't have to do with war, that has to do with being on the beach at the time when someone drowned. What's the relationship between that incident and war, and why did you choose to start your book with that?
That incident had just happened shortly before I started the book. And while I was writing, I realized that I wanted to establish a moral baseline for this book. And I knew part of it would be global human rights, universal human rights. But I knew I'd be writing about killing and death and dying. And I wanted to establish a baseline that comes out of our personal experience, not out of moralistic thinking, not out of somebody's standards. And so it's always important for me to go right to human experience and find in it what we need to know and what we need to be looking at. And immediately that incident popped into my mind, and I started writing about it. And realizing that the reason it popped into my mind is that I found myself on the beach one day where a man had just drowned trying to save his son, successfully saving his son, but he drowned in the process. This was up above Bodega Bay. Everybody on the beach was in tears, in grief, and nobody knew each other. Everybody was there for their own individual or family or little group day at the beach. But there was this collective feeling there. And I talked to a few people, and I realized how we all, and myself included at that moment, participate in the loss, the tragic loss of another human being. I instantly realized how polar opposite that is to how we treat killing in war. And that really stark contrast seemed to me to be very important to set what I consider to be a moral base for the book. We as human beings instantaneously have this kind of shared grief, and we cut it off in relation to war. We hear about the soldiers killing civilians, we hear about the soldiers being killed, and we push back. I wanted to bring those connections back together.
I'm doing this show today partly because it's Memorial Day, and these national patriotic holidays always bring up a lot of mixed feelings for me because, of course, I grieve for our soldiers who die in war, but at the same time, I always feel like to participate in that, to participate in the heroicization of one group of men who are killed because they sort of did it in the service of our country, that means that I'm participating in the militarization that pervades our culture. And then I step back from that and think, well, isn't that somewhat the failure of empathy that you're talking about in the book? So what do you think about that?
You know, you took the words right out of my mouth. While you were talking, I'm thinking, it's empathy that brings you back in. And if you approach the killing of soldiers from a standpoint of empathy, what I found when I did that is that these are expendable lives. These are human beings that our country and every country that has a military has turned into expendable lives, violating every principle of universal human rights. We've set aside a group of people who can be sent to war to kill, which violates their own humanity, and who are set aside to be killed because it's expected that some soldiers, in China's many soldiers, will be killed in war. So as a society, as a world, we set aside these group of people, and for the most part they're men. And so when I went from that, once I recognized that, I went into looking at it from the standpoint of how we construct masculinity to reduce men to expendable lives. If that's where the empathy comes in, because when you start looking at how that is done from an empathetic position, if that was me, I was put through this training, I was expected to go out every day, I wake up knowing that this might be the day that I'm killed. You know, how would I be living? How would I be experiencing? What would I be like at 14 thinking, gee, I'm going to have to serve my country when I'm 19. And gee, look, I just came from these movies or played these video games. I could be one of those who got killed. You can't even keep that in your consciousness when you're 14. You know, so we've built this massive thing. And then around that, and this gets to the point of your question, we have this very elegant term that the politicians and the president use many times a day, the soldier's sacrifice, which is supposed to pull us in to a patriotism behind those soldiers so that they will not have died in vain. And then it goes another step, that we have to keep fighting in war so that the ones who have died will not die in vain. There is every reason to be empathetic with soldiers who have been in combat, with those who have been killed, with their families, but to not be sympathetic with the country that put them there and the patriotism that holds it in place. Even though I don't consider myself patriotic in the traditional sense of the term, and most people I know don't, most of us have this confusion about, you know, not wanting to turn against a soldier's been killed or some that have been terribly wounded, those who walk around with PTSD for most of their lives. But that's the false question. The question is, how can we keep it from happening?
So you mentioned the concept of how we construct masculinity early in the book. You write, core masculinity contains both men's expendability and their contempt for women. What do you mean by that?
Yeah, it's a pretty loaded statement, isn't it? I define core masculinity as a socialized aggression. And I need to be very clear at the outset that I see no evidence of innate violence in men. I do not see it coming from testosterone or from Y chromosomes. I see it coming from socialization. Until we stop socializing boys and men the way we do, we won't know what testosterone or Y chromosomes do. So be very clear on that. But what I did find when I was doing the research on this book was that aggression has an ostensible cause to it in the socialization of masculinity. Because boys are still being raised to believe that they're going to be the protectors of children, of women, of their community, of their country. And in that protector role, you can't put somebody in a protector role without giving them the means to protect themselves. So they have to be aggressive. And in all of that is this contempt for women. If you're set up to be an expendable life, somebody who can be sent to war to be killed, there's got to be some anger someplace about that. And why are you expendable? Because you're protecting us. Ultimately, we become the cause of you having to put your body on the line and knowing that you might die when you're 19. I'm not saying that this is all of the reason that there's misogyny in this world, but it's a dual process. We expect men to protect us. And I'll give a personal example of this very quickly. Recently, I was very seriously threatened by a man who is in my neighborhood. And the first thing I did was call my brother. You know, I've been a radical feminist since 1967. I know, you know, all of this stuff. I've written this book about masculinity. But I needed him to come and stay with me until I got through this crisis. So, you know, I don't think any of us are really exempt from that kind of thing.
At the same time, I mean, someone hearing you talk might assume that a society that was demilitarized would not be socializing men in this way and would therefore have less violence against women. But you actually look at some countries that don't have militaries, Costa Rica, for instance, and that's not what you found.
I was really shocked when I went to Costa Rica because I was going there to look at a demilitarized country, and that is, of course, what I saw. But I also saw an enormous condition of violence against women, beginning with the subject of my first book, the trafficking of women. The sex tours going into Costa Rica they couldn't be higher anyplace else in the world. You go into Google and want to find out something about Costa Rican women, and you get at least 6 pages of agencies for sex tours where you can go and buy Costa Rican women. Then I started looking at the work that's being done in Costa Rica on this subject. 60% of Costa Rican women will be subject to violence by a man at some point in their lifetime. Femicide is an actual word in everyday conversation in Costa Rica. The murder of women is very high, and there is no military, which is what really brought home to me exactly where I was in consciousness raising in 1967. And that is, you can fix all these other issues, but if you don't fix men, if men and masculinity are not remade, you don't get world peace.
I'm Kay Raphael, speaking with Kathleen Barry, who's the author of the book Unmaking War, Remaking Men, How Empathy Can Reshape Our Politics, Our Soldiers, and Ourselves. So how do we remake men?
Well, first of all, let me rephrase that. It's the job of men to remake themselves. We've been doing a lot for men for a long time. Women's job is to break out of the expectations that we have of men. I also think this is where empathy comes in strongly, that we can understand that men are put in a situation where they're expected to behave in a certain kind of way. And if through empathy we no longer require that protector role, or that you're stronger than I am, or however it comes out, we can begin to reshape that. For me, in writing this book specific to war, the way I look at remaking men is looking at the war resistors who have remade themselves. They're in combat, or they've just come back from combat, and at some moment say, I can't do this anymore. I can't go down this road. Because some feeling entered into them, a feeling of remorse that the military had tried to drum out of them. And at that moment, you see a man standing up to his commander, to all of his buddies, to the United States military and the President of the United States. That's a huge, huge thing to do when a man says, I won't do this anymore. And they either go AWOL or they apply for conscientious objector. However it happens, they're going to be punished by the military for not wanting to kill anymore. And they take whatever is happening and in that represent to us a profound moment where a human being changes himself. I'm in awe of some of these resistors. When Ethan McCord arrived on the scene after that shootout that came out in the WikiLeaks video that most of us have seen, the shootout against from the helicopter to the reporters, and he arrived on the scene and there were two babies in a car who were screaming and they'd both been shot, their father had been killed. He did absolutely what he was not supposed to do. He picked up those babies and took them to a military truck to be taken to a hospital. That's not what a soldier is supposed to do in combat. Those were Iraqi babies. You don't give a damn about Iraqis when you're in combat. But something clicked for him. And he said, when he's talked about it, at that moment, he looked at those children and he said, they're the age of my children. That's human connection.
Okay, but I have to challenge that a little bit. I feel like there's a way in which on the left, those of us who want to see war end, privilege the voices of men who have been there and then seen the error of that way of relating to people. And they do.
You are listening to KBOO, Portland, Oregon. 90.7 FM on your Portland dial, KBOO.FM on your everywhere on earth internet dial. Stay safe, stay sane, stay tuned. KBOO, the best in community radio.
KBOO Community Radio holds open meetings concerning the operations and programming of KBOO in accordance with requirements of the Communications Act of 1934 and certification requirements of the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Information about KBOO Community Radio's open meeting policy is available at our website at kboo.fm. The Finance Committee meets on the third Thursday of the month at 5:30 p.m. This month's meeting will be held online through a public video conference. A public link and phone number to attend the meeting can be found at our website at kboo.fm. Please visit our website to verify if a meeting is being held.
The time is 7:54. You are listening to KBOO 90.7. We are at 90.7 in Portland, 104.3 FM in Philomath, and we're at 91.9 FM in Hood River, and we stream at kboo.fm. Listen. So welcome. We're going to start the program a little bit early. The Different Nature program usually starts at 8 p.m., but we have a few extra minutes here, 5 minutes. So let's see. I'm going to find some music here. Something exciting to listen to. We're going to be listening to the Art Ensemble of Chicago coming up in a few more minutes, but we'll listen to a piece by the Art Ensemble recorded in Africa. It's a piece called Eric T. It was composed by Joseph Jarman. It's on the Art Ensemble of Soweto album. And coming up at 8, we will be talking a little bit more about the Art Ensemble of Chicago and a special on their music tonight. So stay tuned and tell people if they enjoy kind of modern jazz, what the Art Ensemble called Great Black Music, Ancient to Future, is their motto. So let's get started. A piece called Eric T., composed by Joseph Jarman, performed by the Art Ensemble of Soweto from an album recorded in South Africa. And welcome, it's now 8 o'clock. It's time for A Different Nature. We're a collective on every Monday. Five of us produce music. It is often on the modern side, outside jazz tonight, for example. We also play electronica, computer music, environmental sounds, modern 21st century composers, computer synthesizer, laptop mixes, mashups. We do all those things this program each Monday evening. So we hope that you have broad tastes when you listen to A Different Nature here. So the Art Ensemble Chicago started back in the 1960s. We'll talk more about them later. We're going to be doing three Art Ensemble specials in November, and this is part one tonight. While going through all the material, which was over 40 albums, I realized that one of the composers who's not as well known is the saxophone player Joseph Jarman, who joined the band in the mid-60s. Saxophone and flute, he also plays percussion, vibraphone, balafon, sings, plays bells, and writes poetry. And we have a rather large amount of material that he composed. Some short jazzy pieces, some longer African drumming and poetry pieces, some balafon music, some bells, some singing. And so tonight we're going to just look at Joseph Jarman's work with the Art Ensemble, and we'll tell you more about it later. So we're going to say you're going to be hearing everything this evening, from crazy jazz to some African percussion to some singing and poetry. So I hope that you'll enjoy this. And we're going to start out with a really amazing piece. This will get us into it. This is called the Old Time South Side Dance, Art Ensemble, from their album Full Force, here on KBOO.